the three fundamental things are water, food, and security. So usually when you're trying to figure out, like, why do these antelope move thousands of kilometers literally every year based on our collaring data, you know, why would they do that? That's a good question. Why do they do it?
Hey everyone, I'm excited to share a new podcast series in partnership with African Parks, Conservation Across Africa. Over the month of June, we sit down with six leaders from African Parks to explore how they're protecting biodiversity and managing some of the most iconic landscapes across the continent. On the third episode of our series on conservation across Africa, we're joined by Mike Fay, Landscape Coordinator for African Parks, to explore the largest land mammal migration on Earth. Every year, nearly 6 million antelope move across vast grasslands from South Sudan into southwestern Ethiopia, a phenomenon now known as the Great Nile Migration. It involves four species of antelope, and this seasonal movement went largely unnoticed until a groundbreaking aerial survey conducted by African Parks and its partners revealed a population twice the size of the Serengeti's famed wildebeest migration. Join us as we unpack the extraordinary journey of 6 million antelope across Africa's grasslands. So we are back with another episode in our series on conservation across Africa in partnership with African Parks. Today we're sitting down with Mike Fay, the Landscape Coordinator for African Parks, and we're going to talk about this groundbreaking aerial survey that's being called the Great Nile Migration, which looked at approximately 6 million antelope moving year-round from South Sudan to southwest Ethiopia. This is work that African Parks kind of uncovered last year in 2024. But Mike, I just want to introduce you to this show. We're very excited to have you speak about this groundbreaking work and talk about, you know, what you do on a day-to-day. So I guess the first thing I would ask you is, could you talk about your position as landscape coordinator, what you do for African Parks, how long you've been with the organization, and then what are some of the cool projects that you're working on right now?
Yeah, so I've been around, as is obvious, I've been around a long time. And I really started working with African Parks right from the inception about 20 years ago. But I didn't really start working for them until about 4 years ago. Previous to that, I worked for the Wildlife Conservation Society all over Central Africa. But like I say, I've been working closely with African Parks for the past 20 years, helping to develop projects in the Central African Republic, in Chad, DRC, Congo, pretty much all of Central Africa. So in 2007, I came to South Sudan right after they separated basically from the north, before they got independence. And we did an aerial survey then, which was the first aerial survey that had been done post the war. And we discovered that this migration of wildlife that's been known for, you know, at least by kind of the colonial press, I guess you'd say, since the 30s, 1930s, had never really been looked at since about 1983. So from 83, when the war really broke out, till 2007, no one really looked at it. So we did a survey in 2007, and we came up with, you know, over a million antelope still in the landscape. So in 2022, I started working for South Sudan, I started working for African Parks to come and work full time here, establishing a project in the migration area. So I spent about 6 or so months speaking to the government and kind of highlighting what we might do as an organization, and the importance of the migration, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, in August of 22, African Parks signed an agreement with the South Sudanese government. So one of the first priorities, obviously, was to get back up in the air and reassess what the situation was with the migration. And so we undertook what was the most extensive survey that had ever been done in the migration area, because it's very big and most people have never kind of conceptualized, you know, the mega kind of survey that you might do. So we drew a polygon on the map that included what we thought was the entire range of these four migratory species of antelope that migrate in South Sudan, and did that survey in 2023. So since then, we've been, you know, kind of getting much more embedded in the landscape, getting to know the different ethnic groups, building bases and having infrastructure that allows us to function in a place that is quite wild and quite insecure in a lot of places. So, you know, it's been kind of a building phase, I guess you'd say, and a getting to know you phase. And we are now kind of getting ready to really, I would say, get into the rubber meets the road phase, which is obviously the most difficult part of what we need to do.
Right. You know, I would ask Mike, one of the initial questions here is, and just for our listeners, you know, we're talking about, you know, approximately, you know, it could be less, it could be more, but around 6 million antelope, you know, migrating over a year-long period from South Sudan to Southwest Ethiopia. What I would ask is, you know, why do animals migrate? Why do antelope specifically migrate? What's the reasoning that they're moving from one area to the next?
Yeah, I mean, large mammals that don't have, you know, the luxury of having agriculture or refrigerators have basic needs that they need to fulfill. Water is a big one. Food is another one, and security is the third one. And pretty much all large mammals, wild large mammals that roam the earth, base their movements on those three things. Sex is another one, but the three fundamental things are water, food, and security. So usually when you're trying to figure out, like, why do these antelope move thousands of kilometers literally every year based on our collaring data? You know, why would they do that? That's a good question. Why do they do it? Well, if you combine those three variables and you start looking at which one is more important in this landscape, depending on the kind of era that you're talking about, security, i.e., the probability, lowering the probability that you'll be killed by a human, is number one. So if you have other imperatives like water, what you're going to want to do is say, okay, in the dry season, when 80% of this landscape completely dries up where there's absolutely no water, I'm going to kind of relinquish a little bit of my security because I need water. If I don't drink water, I will die. So I'm going to lower my tolerance to humans, and I'm going to kind of like say, okay, I'm going to attempt to get as close as I possibly can to these guys because I need water, and they monopolize all the water resources in the dry season. So that's a big factor. And then food, generally speaking, here is relatively abundant compared to, you know, a lot of other species that might be migrating for food. So really the dynamic here is okay, if I have enough water to drink, I'll stay as far as I possibly can get from human beings, because the probability that I'll get killed by a human is lower. And then as the seasons vary, because you get a small wet season and a big wet season, and you never know when that's going to be as a large mammal, you know, you gauge your movement based on the anticipation of that or the indications of that. But then every once in a while, you know, it dries out again, so you have to go back, right? And you end up going back and forth, still working on that dynamic of staying as far away from humans as you can possibly get and having enough water to drink. So that's really why they move.
And then in this migration pattern, I mean, you're talking about millions and millions of antelope specifically here, but during that journey, what are some threats that these antelopes face? I mean, you just discussed humans and security right there. You talked about food, water, but are there other animal species that, you know, pose threats to these antelope along their journey from one place to the next? Is it humans? Is it hunting? Is it poaching? You know, what are some threats that they face along this great journey that they take? Because in my head, I can just imagine that you have this massive amount of, you know, animals that are moving. There's got to be some roadblocks along the way that they're facing.
Yeah, I mean, this landscape is, from a kind of large mammals point of view, again, relatively benign, other than the fact that it does dry out to a large extent in the dry season. So if there were no humans on Earth, or there were no humans in South Sudan, the number of threats that these animals face is relatively low, you know, because even disease, a lot of times the real epidemics come in through domestic animals. So yeah, they'd be facing large predators. They would be facing an extreme drought. And those can be, you know, impactful, especially drought. If you had, say, a year where really there was absolutely no water, but this migration abuts the Nile River. So in that case, if there were no humans, the probability that you would not find water is very low. So really, you know, and it's kind of the planet we live on, the threats that these animals face today are almost 100% related to humans. And some of those are direct threats and others are indirect threats. So hunting is absolutely 100% a major threat to the continued existence of this antelope population. And the levels of hunting are definitely going up. But then you have this kind of other major factor here, where we are transitioning from a relatively traditional kind of land use scenario where you have ethnic groups that occupy certain areas and don't normally venture very far into the hinterland because they encounter other ethnic groups with which they compete or have skirmishes with or have cattle raiding events with or other things. So you've ended up with these hinterlands between human populations. So that's where the antelope find their space, right? But those areas, once again, are occupied by humans because they have permanent water. So again, these antelope are kind of in between the human zones, between the ethnic groups, when water is abundant, and then when water becomes scarce in the dry season, they have to go to one side or the other, to whatever ethnic group they're going to encounter. So as we transition from that traditional landscape to a much more modern nation state landscape, where you have roads and human populations become, you know, homogenous, where any ethnic group can go anywhere in the country and settle and do what they want normally, the exposure of wildlife to kind of that modern world where now, you know, if you get killed 400 kilometers from Juba, you can be in Juba fresh in one day. Whereas in that other world that they lived in not too long ago, that wouldn't happen. That would have never happened, right? So linear infrastructure, road building, which is happening quickly here, is a major threat to the existence of these antelope, especially when they go perpendicular to the migratory paths. So if you have a million antelope crossing a particular area and all of a sudden a road goes in perpendicular to that migration, and there's no modern management that has been brought along with the modern infrastructure that that is being built, then you can see a collapse in these populations very quickly. And in Central Asia, you know, they've seen that happen with the antelope species in Kazakhstan and Mongolia and other places in Central Asia.
I will say, Mike, it's interesting that you bring that up. Last week, I had a conversation with this company called Ecometric Solutions. And what they do is they have this software where you can go in, basically plant the boundary of your property. Let's say you're a manufacturer and you have a manufacturing facility. You can go on the software, plant the boundary of what you own land-wise, and then it will grade your ecosystem based on, you know, how it's impacting the land, the people, the biodiversity around that area. And the idea for the software, it got started, I think, in the early 2000s because the federal interstate was looking to build across the U.S. a lot of highways. And they came to Ecometric Solutions and was like, hey, can you develop a platform for us to see how, when we build roads, how it's going to impact the ecosystem around it? And in this case, I brought that up because it's very fresh on my mind. I had this meeting last week. But in this case, it's very similar. I mean, in South Sudan, all the way across to Southwest Ethiopia, this migration of antelope, when building roads, it could, it's a roadblock. It's literally a roadblock for these antelope along their path from one place to the next. So, you know, something looking at like an ecosystem assessment when the government or whoever's building these roads could be a very valuable thing, because then it sees how it's going to impact the local communities, the local wildlife, the biodiversity of the area. But it's all very interesting. I know that's kind of like a side point, but just a conversation I had last week.
Yeah, I mean, normally, as you transition into a modern kind of nation state structure, and as you kind of build infrastructure and humans start to become more and more dense on the landscape, and you have agriculture and you have roads and you have, you know, industrial projects like oil or mining or whatever it is, you know, one of the first things you want to do is to come up with a land use management plan that says, okay, we're going to designate these areas as protected areas, these areas as traditional areas where people practice traditional cultural use of the land, and these are for development. So here's where oil is going to be, here's where your diamonds and your gold are going to be, this is where you're going to do industrial agriculture, all those things. So right now, one of our priorities here is to convince the government that we actually need a comprehensive land use management plan for this migratory landscape. Because if we don't have it, and these threats continue to build as they are, the writing is on the wall. The writing is already on the wall. And so we need to kind of, you know, get to the point where we unify all of the different kind of stakeholders, and that's up to the government to say, okay, guys, you know, oil ministry, agriculture ministry, roads ministry, mining ministry, all of us need to get together and agree that we're going to come up with a land use management plan for this. And then any project that's proposed needs to be accompanied by an EIA. And normally the EIA would have a plan that is funded that would mitigate, you know, the threat to whatever resource you're trying to manage for. So in this case, the migratory landscape, you want those antelope to survive. So if somebody's going to build a road, you say, okay, well, we're going to need to establish a corridor on that road. We're going to have an entry point and an exit point to where that corridor is going to cross. It's going to be guarded and there will be no hunting along that corridor. So that doesn't preclude building the road. It just means we need to manage the wildlife when they're kind of traversing that road in harm's way. Of course, the road can't become a barrier. So if you build a 6 meter tall dike and the animals can't get across it, or you build a canal or you build any other infrastructure, one of the interesting threats that we have here is the Jonglei Canal, which was built in the 1980s, which never actually functioned. But the idea there was to take the water from the White Nile and divert it from the Great Sud Swamp so that they would lower the evaporation as it went through the swamp so that Egypt could receive more water. And the war broke out before they finished it, but they almost completed it. So you have this gigantic canal on the east side of the river, which up until a few years ago was not a particularly important threat to the wildlife because they could get up and over the dikes, swim across the canal and get to the other side and get to the Nile River, and all that land to the west was still open. But as the last few years have been years of flooding, the floods of the Nile have come right to the banks of the dike of that canal, and all of the people that used to live to the west have moved on to the dikes of the canal. So it's become basically a linear village that's about 200 kilometers long. And therefore, once again, you know, that is this barrier to the movement of wildlife, not because of the dike or the canal per se, but now it's 100% occupied by people in a linear way. And all of those people have guns and all of those people hunt. And so you've now blocked their passage to the west. That's a huge threat, you know. And so, you know, we've obviously listed many of these threats. We've been talking about these threats. We've been reaching out to people who can make decisions about how we can start this land use management planning process.
So I would ask, if we're looking just at South Sudan here, the note that I have down is, you know, South Sudan is one of the world's youngest and one of its most fragile nations, emerging from decades of conflict with limited infrastructure, education, healthcare, or sustainable food systems. Kind of tying that directly to this land use management and this plan and working with government, the mining sector, all of these different stakeholders. When you have a nation that's, you know, brand new, that's developing, how do you go about, you know, talking to governments when they might have massive economic priorities and you're trying to conserve a species and make sure a species doesn't have any roadblocks along its way of migrating? It seems kind of complicated to me and like a hard conversation because governments have so many priorities. And a lot of times what I've seen is greed plays a big factor in a lot of things. Yeah, I would ask you that. I mean, how difficult is that talking to governments, especially like the government of South Sudan, who is trying to become more and more developed as one of the world's, you know, youngest nations and fragile nations?
Yeah, another good question. What I would say is if if you want to sleep well at night and you want to not have constant kind of anxiety and worries in your life, don't become a conservationist. But, humans are on the march. There's 8.5 billion of us. Everybody wants to use more resources. Everybody wants to have more, not less. They want to be better off, not worse off. And the general trend is that not only, have we seen our populations explode on the planet, but the per capita consumption has also exploded. So it's all fine and good to say, we need to preserve this migration of antelope. But as you say, in this country, people are thinking about their next meal if they're living outside of the city. That's their biggest priority is, what am I going to eat tonight? Not even tomorrow, but what am I going to eat tonight? And so if there's an antelope to be eaten and you're hungry, that's what you do. And that happens thousands of times a day in this landscape. So there's that. But then, like you say, if you look at, what we would call in the United States the highest and best use of the land, dedicating it to a relatively low value thing like a migrating antelope rather than a hectare of productive agricultural land or a mine or an oil well or transportation avenues that open up your country to commerce and kind of healthcare and education, then yeah, it's something that is extremely difficult to imagine. But what I would say is there's a way to have your cake and eat it too, right? There's no reason why you should not think about, can we preserve this migration? What economic value does it have? Well, the first huge economic value that it has here is that probably 80% or more of the animal protein that the people who live in this landscape eat is these migratory antelope. So if those migratory antelope disappear, they're going to have to find another source of food, right? And animal protein comes in two forms here. It comes in the form of antelope, and it comes in the form of fish, right? So if you liquidate that asset, either the fish or the antelope, you end up, like a lot of people on Earth, you've eliminated your main source of food, but you haven't found an alternative, right? And so you're worse off rather than better off. And we saw that with the North American native populations, just like we're seeing here, right? As resources get destroyed, people don't necessarily become better off. They can become a lot worse off. And I think that rural people here understand that. They understand that they depend on these animals. So when you talk to them about perpetuating these populations, they say, hell yeah, we want these antelope. We depend on these antelope.
So I do want to pivot a little bit, Mike, into the work of African Parks with this aerial survey. I'm interested because in the beginning, when you were introducing this migration, the Great Nile migration, you had talked about, I think it wasn't, correct me here, but I think in 2023, the aerial survey commenced, it started, and then 2024, the results were released. So I'm just curious about that year-long period. Was aerial surveys going on the entire time? What was the process of gathering data? And then what did African Parks do with the data once it had it? And then another question I'll add, I know this is a lot of questions, but you did mention collaring in the beginning, kind of tracking these species, seeing where they're going. So yeah, just talking about this whole process of the aerial survey, 2023 to 2024, how that all worked, and then, you know, what's going on today?
Yeah, so like any kind of scientific endeavor, data are extremely important. You know, you have to know what you're talking about. You know, if you're a chemist, having the periodic table and knowing that these elements exist and how they behave and everything else is essential if you're going to do chemistry, right? And so if you're trying to manage wildlife, which are impacted by many variables, one of which is humans, then what you really want to know is not just how many animals do we have, but where are they? Why are they there? How do they interact with the human populations? What's their juxtaposition with humanity and other structures? What's their proximity to water? What's their proximity to food? All of the factors that would add up to their survival. So the first cut is to say, okay, we've got this area of 125,000 square kilometers. No one has really looked in detail at this population forever, pretty much, because no one had ever surveyed the entire migratory landscape in one fell swoop. So you say, okay, first cut, we don't know what's going on. We're going to take airplanes and we're going to systematically fly over this entire landscape in a short amount of time. And we're going to get a snapshot of the populations of wildlife, all the human infrastructure, the vegetation, the water, any other variable that you add into that equation. So it's not just about counting wildlife. It's basically drawing a map of all of those different variables in the landscape. So the methodology that is typically used is you fly in straight lines across the landscape. You block it up into blocks, and it's all statistically kind of figured out as to its validity statistically. And you want to have as high a sample size as you possibly can, because the higher the sample, the more statistically kind of tight the numbers are. So when you're doing a broad stroke kind of one-off, survey that has to be done in a short amount of time, because you don't want to be surveying over months because those antelope move every day. So you're not getting a snapshot. You're getting all a bunch of gobbledygook, right? So you need to really take a snapshot. So you have to do it quickly, use multiple aircraft. And typically what people do is they count the animals using observers out of either side of the airplane in a strip that is designated, before you fly. And you know the strip because you put bands outside the airplane, and you can see, and the counters only count between those sticks, and they count the wildlife as it goes by. The sample size depends on how much time and money you spend. And the minimum that you want to get is usually about a 3% survey, i.e. you actually count the animals over 3% of that landscape in a systematic way. And you do the mathematics and you say, okay, we extrapolate the 3% to 100%. How many do we have? There's obviously a lot of variables in there that could make your plus or minus bigger or smaller. And that's why when you say 6 million, it's like 6 million plus or minus a huge number, right? And so one of the things, and getting back to the question of why did it take so long to come out with a result after the survey, what people have started to do is attach photograph cameras to the inside of the airplane that mimic the view of the observers and take pictures all along the way to actually have a photographic record of what that observer saw. And then you take those photos and you literally, using software that annotates the photos, and it's a very complex databasing system, But unfortunately, AI has not, solved the task of automated counting yet, where we have, and in this case, we had six people counting the antelope along the band of photography for every single transect, tens of thousands of photos. So that took about 7 months for those counters to actually tabulate the antelope that were seen by the cameras. And then we compared that to what the observers saw. So we have two data sets, one the observer data set and the other the camera data set. And we compared those two things. And there is variation, but in general, the observers did quite well. And the cameras, you know, also obviously are quite objective, right? But there's always a question of, you know, is the strip width exact? And is the height above the ground of the aircraft correct? Is it? So there's a lot of variables that could introduce error into your system, even if it's an objective photograph. So this year, in fact, we're repeating that survey, and we're doing it right now. In fact, I was flying on it this morning, where we're just using cameras now. No more human observers, because they're much less objective, obviously, than cameras are. And you know, the fact that you can actually see the antelope in these photos and you can count them one by one very objectively considerably reduces the error. But at the same time, things that are generally difficult to count, like, oh, we flew over a village, you know, how many huts were there? How many cattle were there? How many dogs were there? How many people were there? How many granaries were there? All those kinds of variables are much more difficult to count with observers. So we find today that most people are transitioning to photographic surveys instead of human observation. But that's why it took us so long to come out with the result, was it took 7 months to count the photos.
Wow. So to your point on AI, you said AI hasn't enhanced enough to be able to count these. In my head, I would be like, man, if AI with machine learning could somehow, you know, take that, I feel like it'd be a lot easier. But it seems like we're years away from AI being able to do that, because that's a hard process. I mean, 7 months initially, that was in 2023, to just count these antelope. You're doing it manually with people just observing, and then also manually, I guess, with the camera, then counting them after the cameras have the footage. So you would hope in the future AI would progress enough to be able to do that for you.
Well, we are working with several different groups who are interested in automating the count and machine learning of counting wildlife from the air. But that obviously is a lot less lucrative than an airplane flying over a highway and having AI determine how many cracks and how big they are and what they need to repair and what they don't. In that case, they have millions of dollars at their disposal to develop their models, their algorithms, whereas wildlife surveys are kind of, you know, low budget normally. Conservation in general. Yeah, is really low budget. So, but there are several groups that we're working with who are actively working with our photography from here, because it's a really good sample and it's clean. And they've gotten to the point now, and we're going to try to do it with the survey we're doing now, where they can with good reliability have the computer tell you whether or not there is an animal in that photo, right? And most photos don't have animals in them, right? So if you can eliminate already 80% of the photos from your sample, then that relieves, you know, that's like one-fifth the work that you have to do now. And we've also gotten to the point where they can count animals. They can't necessarily distinguish the species, but they can count animals in a photo with good reliability, not fantastic reliability, but good reliability. But if you then back that up with human counting of a sample of those photos, you can correlate those two things and come up with a good number. So there is a lot of progress with AI, and I think that in the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to be able to reliably process these photos using AI. And then we're only going to have to count a subset of those photos to validate the AI work. And I think it's not far away. It'll happen soon. But for this survey, we're going to be giving those photos to these guys, and we're going to see what we come up with. Hopefully, almost for sure, we're going to be able to eliminate the photos that don't have animals in them. And that'll reduce our work by 5 times. And we may actually even be able to count, but probably not on this survey, but certainly in 2027, 2028, I think that will happen.
Right. And I'll tell you, Mike, so this series we're doing with African Parks, it's 6 episodes. So this is one of the 6. In almost every episode, we talked about some form of conservation across Africa, species conservation. And we've talked a lot about, you know, tracking the species, in this case, collaring the species. You know, you talked about how valuable data is and just gathering data, having data on these animals. For this project, is there an element of tracking, collaring the animals along their journey? I mean, we know about the photography that's happening, but is there anything with the animals themselves that they're getting collared, they're being tracked? Is there any of that happening?
Yeah. So, you know, if you get back to the survey, that gives you a snapshot, right? Okay. In like right now, May of 2025, over a 10-day period, a 12-day period, we're going to have a snapshot of where the wildlife was, where the people were, what the linear infrastructure looked like for the entire landscape in the here and now. But 2 weeks from now, that picture is going to be significantly different, especially from the wildlife perspective. So we know that these antelope move a lot, right? And so in 2023 already, we collared about 150 animals, most of which were in the migratory species, the 4 migratory species. And that allowed us to see not just where an individual went, but to distinguish kind of subpopulations of those species. The problem we face is collaring is very expensive. Once again, we don't have unlimited funding. And so if you look at the percentage of the cob that we, which is the main species of migratory antelope here, we have only collared 0.0024% of the population. So again, you know, you're trying to surmise the movement of millions of antelope from 150 individuals, you know, and so if that individual happens to be old and maybe has a little bit of arthritis or whatever, maybe its movement pattern is totally different from 90% of the population. So generally speaking, you know, from my point of view, we'd want to have a much higher percentage of the wildlife collared to be able to really figure out in a high density way where they are going and therefore why they're doing it, right? But what's really interesting is, you know, we've already discovered, for instance, that the lions in this landscape, because of the high seasonality of the water availability and the movement of most of their prey, they have home ranges that are 10 times bigger than any lion that's been recorded before, right? And these antelope are literally moving thousands of kilometers per year. You know, that's also not normal. That's a much higher number than the majority of even migratory species. So we're learning a lot, and we are seeing the general patterns of movement, and that helps a lot in figuring out where the corridors are, what the relationship between humans and wildlife is. We can really measure and see like that the buffer, the minimum buffer between humans and wildlife. When you see them moving and they get close to that human zone and they hover around there and then they move around it. So it's really amazing data. There's just not enough of it. So the conclusions that we draw from it are relatively kind of general conclusions. They're not hard and fast, like we've figured it all out kind of conclusions. And it's really about sample size.
So a couple last questions here for you, Mike. The first is, I mean, we talk about 2023 is when that last aerial survey started. Now you're talking about a survey that's happening now. What is African Parks hoping to accomplish with this aerial survey compared to the last one? And then will this one also run, or maybe not, maybe I can answer the question myself, but will it also run this period of 7 months? Or do you believe that since you're just using cameras, it's going to decrease by a good bit for you to actually gather that data and be able to release that data?
Yeah. So on the first point, we're doing this survey at more or less the same time seasonally, right? Not on the same dates, but very close to the same dates. But you try to replicate the survey. You wanna do it more or less when the animals are facing the same environmental conditions. Which right now we're at the beginning of the wet season. They've already moved out of their dry season range. And they're relatively stationary right now because they've kind of moved farther out into the landscape where they're comfortable, far away from humans, and they might get more drought coming in. So they might go back toward water before they're done. But this is a relatively stable period of time. So the reason we're doing it is because in general, you want to keep tabs on your wildlife, and the normal rhythm that AP kind of uses is every 2 years. You want to have an assessment to see what the trend is in your wildlife populations. And here, because the threat levels are changing extremely fast, especially vis-a-vis resettlement and linear infrastructure, it's really about yes, monitoring what the change has been based on all of the threats we're seeing to see if we're looking at a massive decline of the population, or you know, even though we witness a lot of use or killing of the wildlife, maybe it's sustainable. You know, we don't really know because we don't have a really good assessment of the offtake throughout this landscape, because that's an enormous job to know that. But we're going to see very quickly if we've lost a significant number of animals in the last 2 years, and we're going to see how much farther humans have gone in the landscape in that time, and that'll give us a reality check on are we behind the power curve in you know, kind of getting this management scenario put in place, because once again, South Sudan, even though it's facing a lot of economic and you know, insecurity challenges, I've never seen a country in Central Africa developing as fast as South Sudan is developing. It's changing very fast.
So I think the last question I'll ask you, Mike, is obviously we have listeners that are going to be tuning into this episode, and you know, that they hear you talk about, you know, collaring something that's very expensive. You've collared, I think, 150 out of millions, and you would love to collar more, but it's super expensive. You don't have that kind of funding. So my question would be, you know, how could people that are listening help the cause, could help with the work that African Parks is doing with this Great Nile migration? Are there ways that they can get involved, that they can help with the great work that you guys are doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the antelope in proximity to water, right? So if you can physically help, then that help is welcome. But the vast majority of people, just like the vast majority of antelope we don't collar, can't help physically, right? And so we have teams of people who do the work, and the more resources that we have, the more work we can do, right? And typically, one of the main, and I wouldn't say the main, but one of the main constraints, and less so with African Parks than a lot of other NGOs, because they have a lot of supporters who believe in them and who give them substantial amounts of money. But really, the easiest way to help is by contributing cash. You know, I mean, that's the universal solvent to getting work done, right? And I would say that right now, and I'm working on kind of the overall vision for this place, but we are definitely underfunded for what we need to accomplish here, and the landscape is changing so fast that if you don't get ahead of the power curve, you know, at a certain point, it doesn't matter how much money you put into the equation, because you're too far behind, right? So not only do we need resources, but we need them the quicker the better, you know, because if we don't get them, we're going to be too far behind, right? And that is a dilemma that we face. But I think that's mainly how people can help, either directly or indirectly, by telling their powerful friends and congress people or whatever it is, hey, this is important, we need to do it.